ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Back in the 1980s, the New York Times architecture critic Paul Goldberger walked into the atrium of the newly opened Trump Tower and liked what he saw. It may well be, he wrote, the most pleasant interior public space to be completed in New York in some years. But now Donald Trump is turning the White House into a palace and planning a triumphal arch down the road. So we've asked Paul to join us later to talk about Trump's taste, from city glitz to Napoleonic grandeur. But first. It didn't take a civil war for Britain to free its slaves. Instead, in 1833, their owners were paid a stupendous amount of money, £20 million, the equivalent today of well over £2 billion. And that cash flowed into every corner of the empire, including Australia. How this country was fashioned by slave money is the subject of a new book, edited by Zoe Laidlaw and Jane Lydon, with a plain, rather grim title, Legacies of British Slavery in Australia and New Zealand. Zoe is a professor of history at the University of Melbourne. She joins us now. Zoe, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much, David. It's great to be here.
Whatever criticism can be levelled at Britain, and there can be lots for the way it ended slavery, I mean, the slaves got nothing, it did mean that it ended without violence. And that was a huge achievement, was it not?
I think I'd question your premise, David. I mean, the violence perhaps came before the end of slavery. The British Caribbean was rife with slave revolts and rebellions, certainly in the 19th century and the 18th century as well. So there was a lot of blood lost in the quest to end slavery. Not much British or white British blood, but a lot of enslaved.
Indeed, and French blood. Sure, but, you know, in the end, it was this money. And this money went everywhere, including to Australia. And therefore, we ask you, where did it go in Australia? What did it do?
Well, the money went, as our project has discovered, all over the place and to all sorts of people. Money flowed in some people who'd received compensation for the slaves that they owned. Brought that compensation money with them, and they entered all the realms that are occurring in the 1830s. So they go into pastoralism, they go into trade, some of them go into shipping and the kind of support services, the financial services of the growing Australian economy. Some people sent their money without arriving in Australia. So lots of British merchant houses, for example, received thousands and thousands of pounds of compensation, equivalent to many millions of pounds of compensation money today. And they invested in, especially in pastoralism, we've discovered. So, you know, sometimes that cash or the promise of that cash came in very large chunks, tens of thousands of pounds. Sometimes the money that had been generated through slavery and through those compensation schemes was just enough to allow someone in perhaps in Britain or in the Caribbean to pay off their debts, take a passage to Australia and kind of start again. So we see it across all the colonies, and we see it in different amounts and to different extents. It's really pervasive, I think.
The money was there just as South Australia was getting on its feet. And I've heard people say, look around Adelaide, those buildings are built with slave money. But is that an exaggeration?
Certainly slave money went towards the building of some of those buildings. And South Australia started, unlike the other Australian colonies, as a company scheme. The South Australian Company begins South Australia. And the people involved in that company, we've traced, you know, quite a few of them were connected to slavery. Some received compensation. More of them were involved in the kind of wider slave economy of the Atlantic. So they're merchants and traders. They didn't necessarily run plantations themselves in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. But absolutely. And I mean, perhaps one of the best known names associated with that colonization of South Australia is George Fyfe Angus. And he eventually did come to South Australia, but he's really instrumental in making that company colonization scheme operable in the mid-1830s. He puts a lot of his own money into South Australia. And he had generated that money from his family business, which was building coaches, actually, in York. But they built them with mahogany that came from Honduras and that was grown with and logged with enslaved labour. They invested in mahogany in Honduras. He went to the Compensation Commission and acted as an agent for all these other Honduran slave owners and collected their money for them. So he was absolutely implicated in slavery, and he's very, very important to South Australia's founding. And we've found stories like that across the Australian continent.
And Angus is a revered name in South Australia.
Absolutely. And because he's a very complicated character, as one of the chapters in our book by Nikita Vanderbilt shows, you know, he's remembered and, you know, it's part of the sort of Australian condition, how we think about our history. But Angus was actually, in some circles, was seen as an abolitionist. So he was opposed to slavery at some level, even while benefiting personally from slavery. He was a very ardent Baptist, and he paid for missionaries to come to South Australia. So he was, for the time, he was quite open to the idea that the Aboriginal people, the Kaurna people around Adelaide, or what became Adelaide, you know, had rights and possessed the soil. So in some ways, you know, he's a good figure for colonisers to look back at and sort of think, well, they weren't all bad. On the other hand, he was absolutely involved in and implicated in that whole slavery economy.
But the complications are what's so fascinating, and that, as the book shows, that quite a lot of this money ended up in sort of quite magnificent bequests.
Yes. I mean, we've traced the money from the 1830s into especially the new colonies of Western Australia, South Australia and Victoria. But then we've been able, in some cases, to trace what happened to that money over time. And obviously this is a very complex story. And so it's not like £1,000 came and then £1,000 did this. It's people brought this money that had been generated from slavery, either directly from slavery or through those compensation payments. They brought it to Australia and then they invested it. Perhaps they became pastoralists on stolen land where they multiplied that money, and then they passed it on to their children. But sometimes they made philanthropic donations. And we've been able in some cases to trace that money down several generations, right through to today, in fact.
To Melbourne University?
Not to Melbourne University, no. I think the slave money goes to Sydney University and possibly, but lots of other institutions, private schools, cultural collections, churches.
Geelong College.
Geelong College, Geelong Grammar, and many other private schools as well. In the case of Geelong Grammar and Geelong College, because Geelong serviced the very wealthy Western District of Victoria, that pastoral community, a lot of those very wealthy pastoralists sent their sons and their daughters as well to school in Geelong. And they were absolutely intent on kind of replicating a certain imperial educational experience for them. So I know that Geelong Grammar, for example, was built, you know, with the explicit intention of kind of creating a Winchester or an Eton for the sons of these Western District pastoralists. And yeah, we've absolutely traced money that came into Western Victoria through the Clyde Company, which is one of the big pastoral enterprises of the 1830s and 40s. And then over the generations was passed down, and then quite a lot actually was given to Geelong Grammar to build, for example, its first music school, to build houses for masters, and just sometimes in kind of cash bequests. So, yes, this money continued to, and in fact continues to today, to influence the society we live in, which I think has been a big surprise for lots of people who found out about our research.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Zoe Laidlaw, one of the editors of the book Legacies of British Slavery in Australia and New Zealand. Zoe, when you talk about pastoralism, it's always struck me that the slave money bought sheep, that these thousands and thousands of pounds bought sheep at a time when the squatters were pouring out into the bush. How right am I there?
Well, you are right, I think. And certainly we've found, especially in the case of Victoria, that Victoria is colonised in the mid-1830s. There's a very violent and rapid expansion of pastoral activity, especially to the west of Melbourne and the west of Geelong. And some of the biggest pastoral enterprises are funded almost wholly by money that had been generated in the Atlantic economy, which is a euphemism for from slavery. So the Clyde Company that I mentioned, but also Neil Black, who's a very prominent pastoralist, they are backed by consortia of merchants in Scotland and in England, who all their money came from slavery. And they funded pastoralists in ways that meant they were capable of surviving the economic depressions that really affected Eastern Australia in the early 1840s. So these enterprises are not only funded by slavery, but that funding and the size of it, the magnitude of the wealth that was invested in them, made them more likely to survive. Within 15, 20, 25 years, enterprises like the Clyde Company, it began with £15,000 of investment, all from slavery in 1836. It's dissolved at the end of the 1850s. By that time, its assets were worth more than £250,000. It was sheep particularly, but it was also cattle.
Yep.
And, I mean, one of the great ironies of the Clyde Company is that the Scottish merchants who invested in it, so they're making all this money from wool. This is at the time that Australian wool really floods the British market and becomes preeminent there. At the same time, into the 1840s, they owned slaves in the United States as well. So those slaves were growing cotton, which this firm was importing to Scotland. So they're involved in both of those huge trades, mercantile operations of the mid-19th century in cotton and in wool production.
So just because you were compensated for your slaves in the West Indies didn't mean you gave up your slaves in the southern states of the United States.
Absolutely not. And I think that was perhaps, you know, historians tend to work in a national context or, the British imperial context, but of course, there's a hugely close connections between Britain and the United States even after the Revolution. And the whole, the commerce of Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow is very much focused on North America as well as the Caribbean.
Zoe, how are you able to research the fate of the slave money in such detail?
Well, we have had a big team of researchers, all funded by the Australian Research Council, which has definitely been necessary. But we began our research by using a database that was put together by researchers in the UK called the Legacies of British Slavery Database, which traced what happened or who claimed all this £20 million of compensation money. Because in the way of the British Empire, when that £20 million is set aside in the mid-1830s, they set up a commission to distribute it, and people, it's very bureaucratic. Anyone who says that they own enslaved people in the Caribbean has to make a claim, and all those records have been kept. And so about 15 years ago, a team in the UK digitised those records and added as much biographical detail in as they could about the people who'd claimed. It's very incomplete because, you know, a surprising number of people called things like John Smith or yes. Tom Brown owned enslaved people. It's very difficult to disentangle. But there's enough of those people where we can, from other sources, work out who they were and what money they got. Now, in fact, so that's where we began, only about 200 individuals of the many thousands who are documented in that database had obvious, were noted as having connections to Australia. Many more, we've added lots more names to that, but it was also a way to then think about how this whole complex entanglement between Australian colonisation and British slavery worked. And so we've gone out and looked at things like all these mercantile firms, the Gladstones, who are really important in British history. William Gladstone was the Prime Minister. His family is absolutely
major slave owners.
Huge slave owners, absolutely huge. And they are one branch of that family, William's first cousins, are the ones who invest in Victoria, for example, in the pastoral companies I was talking about. So we looked. Lots of people saw that slavery was going to end, lots of owners of enslaved people, and they dissolved their holdings. They sold off their property in the Caribbean ahead of emancipation, but of course they still had all the money that they'd made from it. So we found that there's literally thousands of connections between that Atlantic economy and the colonisation of Australia.
And there's a website which anyone can go to and check names to see if they have any connections to this. And we'll put the address of that website up on our own site. Zoe, you mentioned then that there are actually two waves, aren't there? There were the slave owners who saw the end coming and sold up. And they were, as you say, you know, awash with money. And then there were the slave owners who were bought out by the government. Did those early slave owners have a particular impact in Australia?
Yes. I mean, we began our project, perhaps a bit oddly, by looking at Western Australia. And Western Australia is colonised. The Swan River Colony is started in 1829. So it's just before British emancipation. You know, all that compensation money goes into the economy in the mid-1830s. But we found that there were quite significant early Western Australians who arrive on Western Australia's first fleet, as it's known, who had sold up in the Caribbean, particularly in what is today Guyana, which was then known as Demerara. And there'd been terrible, we spoke about the violence of the end of slavery. There'd been terrible rebellion in Demerara in 1823. And some of these families clearly feared for their lives and also for the profitability of their investments. They sell up in Demerara. Sometimes coming via Britain, they come to Western Australia and become their pastoralists. They become involved in, you know, the very violent acquisition of the land around what is today Perth from the Noongar people. And they also attempt in some cases to sort of replicate some of the forms of agriculture that they had experience of in the Caribbean. So I've been talking before about pastoralism in southeastern Australia. You know, wool is pretty different to cotton. But in around Perth, around Swan River, they find, you know, wood akin to mahogany. They talk about perhaps they could grow sugar. So it's not only bringing the money, it's also bringing the kind of mindset and an approach to land that's not theirs that they had enjoyed for decades and sometimes centuries in the Caribbean.
Did they, and by the they, I mean the ones who sold up and got out and the ones who were compensated and sent their money to Australia, did that money come with an attitude towards Indigenous Australians?
Yes, I think absolutely. It came, well, let's say it came with an attitude to the rest of the world. It came with an attitude, you know, an imperial mindset that was very racist. So these people who had, you know, all their wealth depended on the labour of enslaved people who were racialised as black, non-white people in the Caribbean. And when they looked at Australia and or the different parts of Australia, they saw Indigenous people who might become labour, cheap labour, because they yeah. weren't white. They saw them as cheap labour. But they also saw the land and they didn't associate that land with Aboriginal ownership. So they are kind of, I think they bring a mentality which is very much about the world being there for their exploitation. They move from exploiting black people in the Caribbean to moving to Australia and stealing land and exploiting Indigenous labour. But they also anticipated being able to bring non-white labour forces, cheap non-white labour forces into Australia to work for them there alongside Aboriginal labour. So these are people who are really promoting the idea that they should perhaps bring indentured labour.
Yes.
So labour on very exploitative contracts from what they call the Malay states, so sort of Southeastern Asia, from China, from India, from the Pacific, notoriously. You know, many of the people who are involved in the early sugar industry in Queensland had either been involved in the Caribbean sugar industry or indeed in US, you know, they'd own slaves in the US. And there's been some terrific work done on that, and some of which is represented in our book.
Now, particular work that you have done is linking some of our most famous governors to the slave trade. What did you discover there?
Well, this was a real shock to us, I think. We thought that the governors were quite a good cohort to explore because they're very well known, and there's at least short biographies of all of them. You know, they're in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. We know quite a lot about their lives, but we had not anticipated. I did a study of the 69 governors of the different Australian colonies before Federation. So from, you know, Arthur Phillip in 1788 right through to 1901.
There are 69 of them, are there?
69.
Good.
I don't think anybody's ever bothered to count them up.
No, I've never heard that figure before.
No, and someone will probably come along and say, oh, you're counting one of the lieutenant governors or something like this. But
we
essentially, you know, there's around 69. And I went back and looked at where they had worked, what kind of employment they'd had, and also where their family wealth had come from. And a lot of those men were, you know, they're certainly quite powerful people before they become governors of an Australian colony. We found that about a quarter of them, their family fortunes had been significantly shaped by wealth made in the Atlantic slave economy, in some cases in very substantial ways. But we also found that 40 of them, so about 60%, had their careers before they came to Australia had been totally embedded in the Caribbean or in West Africa, where slaves were, you know, stolen from. So they'd been in the Navy, they'd been governors of those Caribbean or West African colonies, they had worked in other capacities in that world. So of all those 69 governors, nearly two-thirds had lives that were absolutely entangled with slavery, either through family fortunes or their careers, that clearly we think did shape the way that they then came to Australia, how they understood what was going on in the Australian colonies, how they interacted with Indigenous peoples, what they thought about things like indentured labour and sugar in Queensland. So it was quite a shock to us, actually, how pervasive this connection with slavery was for the governors.
Zoe, come on, name some names.
Well, a personal favourite, because I work in Melbourne and live near a big shopping centre called Berkeley Square, is Henry Berkeley, who was the governor of Victoria from 1856 to 63. Now, Henry Berkeley's family, he grew up in London, but his family were extremely wealthy West India merchants. So they traded in the sugar, essentially, that was grown in the Caribbean. They also became, because they lent money to planters, in sugar planters in the Caribbean, they came to own many plantations. The four partners, he and his father were partners with two other men at the time of emancipation. Between them, those partners received about £160,000 compensation.
Whoa!
I know. It's a really, the merchant firms, the partners in merchant firms are the biggest beneficiaries of that compensation because they financed the Caribbean. So they had ended up, even if they lived in Britain, they'd ended up owning plantations and enslaved people in the Caribbean. But after that, Berkeley becomes perhaps unsurprisingly, a big advocate for the interests of planters after emancipation. They felt very hard done by, despite having received all this compensation money. They were very bitter about what had happened. And Barclay became an MP. He spoke up for what planters, you know, what they wanted. And really what they wanted now was cheap labour and all sorts of deals from the government, which they mostly didn't get. But he then became a governor. He went first to British Guyana. He was the governor there where he owned plantations, quite a conflict of interest, then Jamaica, and then he came to Australia, to Victoria. And, you know, it's difficult to see the exact, you know, what did he do in Guyana that affected what he did when he was in Victoria. But we do see interesting things like the way that he would compare the Aboriginal people of Victoria to the Indigenous people, actually, of British Guyana, and, you know, very racist language that he used in both cases. But he sort of drew on his Caribbean experience and his wealth and position as a planter, his kind of imperial mindset, when he was working here in Australia.
You mentioned the Australian Dictionary of Biography a moment ago. Are corrections flowing through to the Dictionary of Biography?
That's an interesting question. We are working with the Australian Dictionary of Biography and with their kind of their other arm, which is People Australia. I think lots of people know about the Australian Dictionary of Biography. It was obviously originally published in book form, but has been digitised for quite some years now. And you can look up people who are important, representative of our nation's history, and, you know, find out all the details of their lives. But we found that a lot of those entries, and this is not just the Australian Dictionary of Biography, it applies to other, like Britain's Oxford Dictionary of National Biography and other similar works, they proved to be much more likely to emphasise an individual who, if they'd been opposed to slavery, that would be kind of mentioned.
Yes.
In fact, sometimes very prominently mentioned in their entries. But if they had been slave owners or benefited from the slave trade or any of this, that tended to be either glossed over or spoken about very euphemistically. So people, it would be mentioned that they were born in Trinidad, but not that their fathers and grandfathers had owned, you know, huge plantations.
Yes.
And that was where all their wealth came from.
But isn't it wonderful that there is so much work still to be done on something like the Dictionary of Biography to get it right?
Absolutely. But what we've been able to do, People Australia is a much more democratic arm of the dictionary, and anybody can have an entry there. I mean, they, you know, they have to be rigorous and historical, but they don't need, it's not something that is only for people who were very important to our history. So we have been writing, and this, if people look at People Australia, which is again free and online, they will find this new set of entries, sometimes updated entries for people, you know, governors who we perhaps need to tell a bit more of the full story but also a lot of people who will never make it into the Australian Dictionary of Biography because they're not significant enough, but who do illustrate and kind of flesh out all these myriad connections to the Atlantic economy and to slavery.
Zoe, it sounds as though there's a lot more work to do.
That's correct. It's also proved really important, I think, for conversations that we've been having with some of our Indigenous collaborators. And, you know, it's wrong to think of that there's a binary between slavery and freedom. Slavery is outlawed, but coercive labour practices, practices akin to slavery, practices that in every way except for the legal framing are slavery, continue. And in Australia, what goes on in Queensland with the South Sea Islanders who are coerced into working on sugar plantations, but also the way that Aboriginal Australians are coerced and exploited as labourers across Australian pastoral industries, whether we're talking, in fact, about Victoria in the 1840s and 50s or Western Australia and the Northern Territory right into the 20th century, that kind of exploitation of Aboriginal labour is also connected to a mindset that thought that slavery was okay and that even if slavery was illegal, that the coercion of labour, of non-white labour, was fine. You know, so we're uncovering those kind of really profound connections as well as those individual stories.
So you're transformative a transformative view of Australia. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Professor Zoe Laidlaw, historian at Melbourne University and one of the editors of Legacies of British Slavery in Australia and New Zealand, and her work continues. Coming up, Trump the Great Builder. Trump was always a builder. Before he decided to remake Washington as a city fit for him to rule, with ballrooms and triumphal arches, he was putting up towers in New York, and high up on each one was his name, with nothing above Trump but the sky. Paul Goldberger has been keeping an eye on Trump the Builder for the last 40 years or so. Paul was the longtime architecture critic for the New York Times, and he then wrote on architecture for the New Yorker. He's also the author of the book, the pretty big title, Why Architecture Matters. Paul, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, the ballroom, how's the design going? Is it getting any better?
Not so far as I've heard, no. It's enormous. It's, I think, more like a convention center or the kind of huge hotel room that you might find in a major city for big meetings than anything that belongs in the White House.
The White House is very carefully not a palace, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, when it was designed at the very end of the 18th century, rather, it was intended to make a very clear statement that this is a democracy, not a monarchy, and that, in fact, it was called the, you know, executive residence originally. It was where the man who ran the country would live, but it was also very deliberately secondary to the Capitol.
Do we know how it was decorated before the interior was completely gutted and rebuilt? Did it have all this gold that Trump is applying?
No. The gold that Trump is implying is all new. Nobody even tries to suggest it has a historical precedent. He's just saying he likes it better this way, and he's treating it as if he owned it, as opposed to being a temporary tenant in a house owned by someone else, which is to say the people.
But it'll be so easy to strip that shit out.
Oh, yeah, that's the least of it. The gold that he's put around his office and elsewhere in the White House is easily fixable. The ballroom will be a bigger problem if he builds his triumphal arch. That, too, will be a bigger problem. There are far, far graver issues in terms of what he's doing to Washington than the gold in his office, yes.
Paul, we have a tradition on this show, whenever we hear a dog, to ask for the dog's name and breed.
Ah, I'm happy to share that with you.
Yes.
Sorry that the dog has intruded.
No. A human touch.
Her name is Lucy, and she is a 17 and a half year old miniature poodle.
Whoa.
So she's getting on in years, and I'm surprised she had the energy to bark right now because she's usually pretty quiet.
Paul, I'm fascinated by the fact that the people who built the White House and Donald Trump are both going to the same kind of architectural vocabulary, classical architecture. What is the attraction for rulers of the style of Rome?
Well, you know, classicism is a big and wide canvas, we might say, on which you can paint a lot of different things. It is the style of Rome, of Greece before it was the style of Rome. It's been the style of so many other things. It's been varied continually, but it's kind of the core vocabulary of Western architecture, really. And you can do all kinds of things with it, and you can read all kinds of meanings into it. You know, in the early years of the U.S., when James Hoban designed the White House, who was an Irish architect. When Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Latrobe were working on the early plans for Washington and early buildings, it was really seen more in connection with both Greece and the Renaissance as a connection to ideals and as a symbol of democracy. We know at other times in our history, such as Albert Speer and Hitler, classical architecture has been a symbol of tyranny. It's been the very opposite thing. In each case, though, I think, even if they're after a very different kind of goal, people tend to feel comfortable with classicism because it reaches all the way back to ancient times, suggests a kind of continuity and almost a validation from that connection of whatever it is they're trying to prove with it. I mean, that's the amazing thing, that, you know, Albert Speer could use classicism to back up Hitler. In the earlier years of the U.S., we used classical architecture to back up democracy and show its validity. So it's a kind of blank slate on which we can write almost anything we want. But of course, there's so many different ways to do it, too. Yeah. I mean, it could be ornate and overdone and overdecorated. It can also be elegant and be sometimes almost as simple and abstract as modern architecture. All depends on who's doing it, what they're doing, what they're trying to say.
But there are rules, aren't there? And if you put,
yes, there if are you put, rules.
If you put a row of columns and then a pediment on top, that's a portico and that is an entrance, which seems to have been overlooked by the designers of the ballroom.
Oh, you've noticed. Yes, good. That you're quite right. That the ballroom has a huge colonnade with a classical pediment on top facing the White House lawn. But in fact, you don't enter it there at all. It's all kind of fake.
While up the road, we have a triumphal arch. Now, that design is evolving as well, isn't it? How are we going there?
The problem there is not just the specifics of that design, but the idea of building anything there at all. You know, it's on a round grassy island on the Virginia side of the bridge that connects the state of Virginia to the center of Washington and goes right into the Lincoln Memorial. On the Virginia side is Arlington National Cemetery, which was created after the Civil War to bury the Union war dead. And the connection between that and the Lincoln Memorial was very, very conscious and intentional. And it's why that area has remained open ever since, so that you would feel a sense of connection between Abraham Lincoln saving the Union and where the people who gave their lives for that were buried. Nobody has ever built on that before. Trump wants to put his arch, which is commemorating, as he said, himself, not any particular war victory, in the middle of that, blocking that view. It kind of reminds me of how you may have noticed in a couple of different world events, either gatherings of heads of state at the G7 or other large conferences like that, or the recent thing the other day with the pictures taken of the Spanish team after they won the World Cup, Trump's tendency to kind of push himself into the foreground in someone else's photo. Well, it's kind of what he's doing with the arch on the city of Washington. You know, that was left open so that you would feel a connection between Lincoln and the war dead buried on the other side of the river, and Trump wants to just push his way into the middle and occupy and block that.
Paul, isn't there supposed to be a commission of some kind which is designed to save Washington
there
from whims
isn't.
Of this kind?
David, you're so right. And until now, it has worked quite well and actually been very, very engaged in a very positive way with so many different things that have happened in Washington. What's happened more recently is that Trump first tried to bypass the entire process of review, was told that that was not possible. So what he did was fire all of the members of these various review committees and commissions and so forth, and replace them with unqualified people who he knew were loyal to him. In one case, it was one of his like executive assistants or something who had no training whatsoever in architecture.
So
what we're really seeing here is not just a failure of the architectural system, we're seeing a failure of democracy because the government is not working as it should.
But Paul, I think you're overlooking the possibility that that arch, once built, with its golden angels on top, mm-hmm. will be a warning for all time against what went wrong under Trump.
Well, David, I think that's a very wonderful and encouraging and optimistic view. I would say that my first hope is that it never get built at all.
Yes.
My second hope is exactly what you've just said, which is that if it's built, then it serves as a warning of the dangers and risks. There's a third possibility, of course, if it's built, which is that people just kind of get used to it, forget the origins of it, and in 50 years, people just think, oh, it's that, you know, arch, whatever. It's just like any other memorial. And they, you know, we have a huge capacity to become accustomed to things and tolerate them, particularly in architecture. That's probably good because, you know, we have to see architecture every day. It's not like a piece of music that if you don't like it, you don't play it, or a movie, if you don't want to see it, you don't see it. Architecture, you kind of have to see because it's there. So I think somehow mentally we learn to tolerate it because it would drive us crazy if we hated it every second of every day. So it may well be that it will be built, and in time, people will just shrug their shoulders and go about their business.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Paul Goldberger, former architecture critic of the New York Times, about the taste of Donald Trump. Now, Paul, perhaps it was as a developer that Trump developed his kind of fundamental way of working, which was always to find a loophole, always to find a way around the rules.
That's a perfect summary of his career. He has specialized in finding zoning loopholes, planning loopholes, labor law loopholes, financing loopholes, all sorts of things. He's been a bull in a china shop his entire career. And I think New Yorkers who had seen him from the very beginning of his career, you know, 45 plus years ago, are not as surprised, perhaps, as people elsewhere in the U.S. have been with the way this has played out.
What sort of things was he building when he was the builder in New York?
When he was the builder, well, a mix of things. He first became a major figure in New York building a hotel next to Grand Central Terminal, the train station, at a time when things were grim in New York, not much was happening. The economy was very bad in the late 70s. And I think there was so much excitement about somebody building anything that the city was very willing to grant him a lot of concessions in terms of, you know, city support, in terms of bending certain regulations, things like that. And then, of course, it was his way to think of that as the new floor rather than an exception for difficult times. So he would demand more and more each time. And then he followed with Trump Tower, his condo building on Fifth Avenue, which seemed, again, at a time in the very early 1980s when New York was only recovering from a very, very difficult period of economic downturn, then, you know, there was also excitement about somebody building something fancy that might bring more money into the city. But in fact, it was very kind of cheap and facile and glib and had a lot of glittery elements to it. Wasn't really all that good as a work of architecture. And he used to spread rumors that then Prince Charles was buying an apartment there. And yes, and it was ridiculous. I mean, the British royal family would not buy an apartment anywhere in New York, but particularly not there, I would think. And they had, and you know, but he got it into the gossip columns. And so people would talk about that. And even if people knew it really wasn't true, it got them talking about it. And that was all he cared about, really. He wanted his building talked about. So he would, but in fact, a lot of the early buyers of these condos were wealthy Russians. And it later became known that, in fact, a lot of this was a place for them to kind of launder money.
But so now, Paul, we have your review. Yes. We have a review of yours written at the time where you were at least fairly pleased by the atrium of Trump Tower.
I was. No, David, you're absolutely right. I can't deny it, and I won't. You know, it was a time when almost everything was kind of glass and concrete. And he built this atrium in the middle of this with a kind of warm rose-colored marble. And I did find that kind of refreshing. And the idea of public space of this sort was refreshing. Trump, of course, did all he could to milk that. And immediately he started putting up posters in the building with a quote from my review.
Oh, no.
But, of course, took it out of context, only the positive lines, and did not quote anything negative that I'd also said. But, in fact, you know, Trump Tower was not a terrible building. I think it he certainly did much worse as the years went on. It's not the greatest building. It's not the worst building. And, in fact, there was a time early in his career when, because he did seem interested in architecture and he talked a good game, that a lot of people thought that he might, in fact, develop into a more sophisticated, public-spirited developer than indeed he did. Then, in fact, he got very involved in Atlantic City and the movement to build casinos in that depressed part of the seashore, and that was a disaster, not just architecturally, but financially.
But you've got to have glitz for a casino. You've got to have,
that's true.
You've got to feel that you're at the circus.
Well, in a certain way, it was his natural habitat. He was at home there because he liked glitz, and that's a kind of building for which glitz is kind of par for the course. So, of course. And but in fact, you know, they made Trump Tower look like the Parthenon. They were such bad buildings, actually, what he built in Los Angeles. And they did not succeed financially because he overextended himself.
No.
And then he started building less, and actually it occurred to him, because he was so obsessed with the idea that his name was a synonym for money and luxury and living well and so forth, he actually started licensing his name to other builders and developers, saying that if you call it the Trump this or the Trump that and give me some of the profits and let me run and organize the project for you, then you'll have a more successful building, I'll make some money. And then he didn't have to go through all the hard work of development. So a lot of what he did was in that category, particularly as the years went on. He did a lot of that. I know of a story of one very then younger developer who had not yet been quite successful, but would go on to develop whole sections of Brooklyn and make an enormous amount of money. Trump apparently called him early on and said, you know, this is a new area. People aren't that interested. They'd come if it had my name on it. I'll let you put my name on your building if you just give me 10% of the ownership of it.
Whoa.
Right, right. To which this gentleman said, no, thank you. But
the art of the deal.
The art of the deal. The art of the deal was often just demanding certain things and throwing tantrums if you didn't get them, or claiming that you'd been successful even if you hadn't, which sadly, you know, has an echo in the situation, say, in Iran. I mean, we're not here to talk politics, but we certainly see many of these same patterns of making hasty, not well thought through decisions, and when things turn bad, just declaring that they're not bad, that you've actually won, that people who think otherwise are wrong or don't know anything.
We hadn't thought about this, but I wonder whether bombs can create loopholes. If so, yes, if so, those two aspects of Trump's career. No, David, stop it. Now, look, Paul, can we turn to you?
Bombs are definitely a form of loophole, yes.
Can we turn to you for an absolute guarantee that his name will not be attached to the ballroom or the triumphal arch?
Well, I think we're pretty sure that, I mean, if he may succeed in getting them built, we still don't know. Because there are lawsuits that several civic organizations, including the National Trust for Historic Preservation, have filed. And so far, while they have not been decisive and final, they seem to be moving through the courts in a way that's been sympathetic to the people who are objecting. We don't know what the final outcome will be. However, I think it's pretty clear that if they are built, they will not be named for him. And the hope of a lot of people is that this process will at least stretch out until a time when he's no longer in the White House. And then a successor can change direction.
And of course, a name can always be chipped off.
Well, as we've seen at the Kennedy Center.
Well, we haven't seen.
Well, right, as we have been told, you're quite right. Thank you for correcting me. As we have been told has happened at the Kennedy Center, but it's also shrouded in a cover so that nobody can see, whether that's because the name has never really been taken off or because he does not want people to see what is in many ways a public humiliation of him because he was ordered by a judge to remove it. I truly don't know what the answer is to that.
Looking for a loophole, probably, Paul. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
David, thank you so much for asking me. It's been great talking with you.
And thanks also to Lucy, who is making herself heard once again, well, I'm glad to say.
She has very strong feelings about the ballroom.
Does she?
Yes, indeed. Indeed, yes. Yes.
She wants one day to lift her leg. No, stop it. Stop it.
Well, you know, many of us are doing it metaphorically, if not literally. So there we are.
Indeed. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, David. Great talking.
I've been talking to Paul Goldberger, former architecture critic for the New York Times, architecture writer for the New Yorker, and author of a book with an absolutely huge title, Why Architecture Matters, about the taste of Trump. And that's the show and the week. Time for some chatterbox. Belinda thought what Professor Brunig and I had to say about Hextet was cavalier. She wrote, it was rather a cavalier discussion, as if massive education debts don't matter. Stronger language was used by some other listeners. There's also been commentary around the ABC. But Rob Brunig wasn't arguing against debt relief. We were discussing means testing. At issue was whether the same debt relief should go to everyone or to those who need it most. Still, it's a very live issue, and with university fees rising, perhaps it's time we took another look at Hextet. That's the show and the week. My thanks as always to the Late Night Live team. Producers Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold, Ali Benton, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Thank you. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.